Well, throughout this series, Love Everyone Life by Life, we've been taking a closer look at what love actually is, how it works, how it operates, what it compels us to do. In fact, we've been trying to operate as students of love. I don't know if we've put that word to it, but that's how I've been stepping into it every single week, is what, how am I learning? How am I growing in this? Because the hope is that if we can learn love, we can bring about a revolutionary movement of love to our city that God himself is behind. And it would change and sort of ripple out into people's lives one life at a time. And our teacher in real love over the course of this series has been Jesus. Now, Jesus has a long track record of trying to teach people things. This goes back all the way to the very beginning of his ministry. His first students were called disciples or followers of Jesus, and he spent a lot of time trying to educate them. But just like today's teachers and students, it doesn't always go as well as you'd plan. In fact, especially as it relates to modern day times, I should know this. It's not easy to educate a student. I should know because I have a kindergartner. My son, Emmett, is 5 years old. He just started kindergarten recently. And I would just say that the first few days of kindergarten, it was a rough start for our household. Seriously, the first day, he somehow managed to walk off the campus without anybody knowing it. And prompted a manhunt. Immediately, let's just say, Emmett's name went on the roll in a different way. People knew who Emmett was. Second day, he manages, like in the middle of his class, he starts complaining and kind of throwing a fit, lays down on the floor and falls asleep in the middle of the class. After he wakes up, he's complaining of a stomach ache and gets sent to the nurse's office. The nurse can't figure out exactly what's wrong with him. And so the assistant principal chooses to get involved, contacts my wife, and Emmett and my wife end up on the phone call for a little while with the assistant principal sort of breaking in every once in a while. That was day two. Day three, we drop Emmett off at school. He walks down the hall by himself. I'm like, great, everything seems to be going better. About 40 minutes later, I get a call from the principal of the school saying, Emmett is in the hallway and will not go into the classroom. And we're not going to force him to go in, but we don't exactly know what we need to do. So could you come help us get your child into class? So I go into the class. Sure enough, I'll never forget, I turn down the hallway and there's no one in the hallway except the principal of the school standing and Emmett sitting in the hallway just looking at her. It was like this like face-off, like an Old West showdown. Like they just were staring at each other. That was day three. Needless to say, when we walk into the school, they're always like, hey, Emmett. Like everybody knows Emmett's name now. He is a little bit of a celebrity at the school. Some days were like that for Jesus and his disciples. No matter how hard he tried to teach something, it just didn't seem to go very well. And I want to share one of these sort of like harder days with you that Jesus had, because it turns out to be a really important lesson as it relates to learning to love people. So before I go into it, though, let me sort of set the scene with you. Jesus has 12 disciples. Two of them are brothers. And they get this private meeting with Jesus, and it also is including their mom. Mom, I think, has angled for this meeting with Jesus. She sits with Jesus and her two sons, and she makes an impassioned plea why these two disciples should get sort of like the seats of honor in Jesus' new empire. Like, hey, Jesus, we're with you, but could you give my sons preferential treatment in how this all goes? And needless to say, when the other 10 disciples find out that the two brothers and mom have been lobbying Jesus for these new positions of power, they are not happy about this. In fact, they're pretty upset about it. In Matthew chapter 20, it picks up the story. It says, when the 10 heard this, they were angry with the two brothers. But Jesus called to them, kind of pulls all 12 together and says, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. It will not be so among you. But whoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus catches his disciples in the middle of their anger and their indignation over this power play by these two brothers, and then he flips on their head the whole reason for getting offended. Like they're all offended, they think they're rightly offended, and then he flips it all over on them and it like comes apart. Because in most kingdoms, people are valued based on how much power that they can gather. How much you have say over indicates how much we should respect or honor you or give you deference. And are we really any different? I mean, that's kind of been the story throughout history. We think we're more enlightened and in many ways, but really, this is what we are taught all the time. I mean, don't we kind of recognize when someone has arrived because no one tells them what to do anymore, right? That's when you know you've arrived. No one tells me what to do anymore. I'm kind of my own boss. I can chart my own schedule. I can make my own priorities. But the way of God's kingdom, Jesus says, is very different. It's not about the amount of power you have. It's about the depth of servanthood in your heart. That's what forges greatness. True greatness. Which is part of the reason, by the way, why we just honored these folks in commissioning, because they're choosing a life of servanthood, not only to God, but to you. And so, they're, like I said, they're not in it for the applause, but it's worth honoring, because Jesus says that's the way of true greatness. Not just getting power, but by being a servant. And it's a tough lesson, by the way. If it's tough for you, believe me, you're in good company, because the disciples were slow at this one. They were slow learners. They were constantly arguing about all this sort of stuff, and Jesus was constantly having to teach and retrain them. And he offered multiple lessons again and again. So he has this one. If you've ever been like frustrated by like, you know what, I tried to tell somebody something and they didn't get it, Jesus knows exactly how you feel, because he says all this to them. He makes this big point, right? You're like, wow, servant, everything. And then immediately, they get to put it into practice. If you follow on in Matthew chapter 20, there's this incredible moment. So they said, like, they leave that moment, and then they go on, and Jesus is going from, like, Jericho to Jerusalem. He's sort of leaving the city, and these blind beggars on the side of the road call out to him. They're like, Jesus, have mercy on us, help us. Now, everybody in his entourage and everybody in the city is going like, forget those guys, don't even pay attention to them. Like, come on, Jesus, you're more important than this. Come on. And Jesus, his attention just gets drawn over there. And eventually, these blind beggars on the side of the road shout him down. And he has an amazing response. He goes over to them and he says, what do you want me to do for you? Jesus, the celebrity in town, Jesus, the Savior of the world, Son of God, essentially responds to them like a server in a restaurant. How may I help you? What can I do for you? It's an amazing picture of what he's been telling people, he then lives out on his own. He's not above serving the needs of some poor blind men on the side of the road. And indeed, he does help them in a way that only he can. It reveals what his life is about and what his words and his actions reflect again and again. Love serves. That's one of the crucial nature of love. Love serves. It's an attitude, but it's also action. It's an attitude and an action. And it seems simple, right? Love serves. Great. Let's move on. Well, if you're like me, I don't know if you've been paying attention to the weeks that we've been doing in this series. You know, there's love cares. Love listens. Love engages. We even talked about, you know, like sitting down and eating meals with people last week. Those are all good. When it comes to love serves, I'm kind of like, that's like my least favorite one. I don't know about you, and I'm the one teaching this today. Like, I'm like, why is that one, maybe that's not the case for you, but for me, and for I think many people, it's kind of like, that's like the least appealing of all the ways that love can be expressed. And I'm like, why is that? What gets in our way? We love the idea of love, right? All you need is love. But we don't always love the idea of serving other people. Sometimes those feel different. And here's what Jesus reminds us of again and again throughout his teachings, is that servanthood will always feel like an unnatural posture if you operate with your agenda in life as the most important thing. If your agenda is number one, then servanthood will never come naturally, because you're serving yourself. You're serving your own agenda first. Think about it. Have you ever been to a restaurant and had a server that you could tell, they're annoyed just because I'm here? Have you ever had that experience? Like, I'm not sure, that's their job, but like, I can tell I'm putting them off just by sitting here. Like, it's an utter inconvenience that you're here doing your job to serve me. Contrast that, though, with the experience of like a great server who treats you like you're the only table in the entire restaurant. You know the difference there? One server has subjugated their agenda to the needs of their table. Like, it's not about me, it's not about why I'm here to actually serve. And it makes them great at serving, because they're not all kind of in their own mind about what they need. They're serving you. Likewise, if you and I show up each day like our agenda is the most important thing going on in our life, serving others in love is always going to be a struggle. It's going to be an afterthought most of the time. But what if you awoke every morning with the awareness that you're actually living in somebody else's universe? Like that breath you're using right now, that's borrowed. That blood, that's borrowed too. The time you have right now, that is a gift that has been lent to you. One of my favorite authors, Dallas Willard, says, like, he reminds me of this all the time. He says, there's no particular reason why things should go my way because I am not in charge of the universe. But yet we don't live like that very often. We assume things should go our way most of the time. And that really irate feeling you get when they don't, that's called entitlement. That, like, why aren't things, why is this traffic light this way? Why are these people so stupid? Why is this, I mean, like, all this stuff in our life, it just comes from this sense of, like, well, it's this assumption that I'm in charge of the universe. Now, we would never say that, but we operate that way. But if you can see that my way is not king, it's not the most important thing, and there's really no reason why things should go your way, then you can truly begin to see needs around you. Because otherwise, our vision's kind of fogged up with all the stuff we have going on. When you can set your agenda aside, you begin to discover, I have bandwidth. I have the ability to actually pay attention and serve and care for the needs around me. If I'm not constantly serving myself, well, then I've got space to serve people in life. You're like walking around going, man, they might need something, versus thinking about what I need done today. Which actually, by the way, as you're kind of on this page, if you really take this seriously, it's going to bring you to one of the greatest tests of faith about living in God's kingdom, because you have to come face to face with this real reality. Will God take care of my needs if I'm not taking care of them? Like, who's going to take care of me if it's not me? And that's what God invites you into by being a part of his kingdom. You can quit being preoccupied with you and your needs, because God is on it. And you're like, well, that sounds nice, but is he really going to be on it? Like, is he going to do it the way that I would do it? Well, maybe not, actually. But he's capable, and he is attentive. And it's, the Bible says he has the resources to supply your needs. But we have to grapple with this. Will God really serve me in love so that I can serve others? You see, serving others in love is an attitude that flows from your perspective as someone served by God in his universe. He serves you, which enables you to serve others. But since we're learning from Jesus about this, right? So we've said we're kind of dedicating ourselves as his students. Let's flip to another one of his, like, masterclass teachings on what it means to serve and love and how those go together. And in fact, it's one of the most famous stories that Jesus ever told. Our senior pastor, John, referred to it in week one of this series, and it's found in Luke chapter 10. And there's so much packed into these verses, I don't have time to go through all of it, but I do want to point out two primary barriers that even if you are open to the idea of serving others in love, you're going to run right into these. And it's better to see it coming so that you can go, if that's what love does, what could derail me from actually living that out? John chapter 10, Jesus, it's recorded that this Jesus has this interaction. It says, just then a lawyer stood up to test Jesus. This is always going to be really interesting. It's going to go well for him. Teacher, he said, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus says to him, what is written in the law, lawyer? How do you read there? Like, what are you reading there? He answers, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. Jesus says to him, you have given the right answer. Do this, and you will live. Should have quit while he's ahead. But wanting to justify himself, he asked Jesus, and who is my neighbor? All right, Jesus, so who's the neighbor here? The lawyer actually answers correctly. And to use our language, he says, all right, what does God want? Love everyone, including God, life by life. That's basically what he says. Love them all, life by life. And Jesus goes, yeah, correct. Go do that. But the lawyer wants specifics, because that sounds a little too broad. You're talking about everyone. What do you mean? You know, like, who is my neighbor? Or who is everyone, life by life? Like, who are we really talking about? Because surely you don't really mean everyone. I mean, I don't know if you've felt that as we've walked through this series. Like, love is awesome, but where am I going to draw the line? I mean, how do you prioritize this? Like, how do you really define everyone, life by life? Because you can't seriously mean love everyone all the time. Jesus replies, as he often does, with a story. Jesus replied, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of robbers who stripped him, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. Now, by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, or kind of like an assistant in the temple, there, super religious person, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, not a Jew, not high on anyone's priority list who is listening to this, while traveling came near him. And when he saw him, he was moved with pity." I would argue that Jesus is telling this story and insinuating that while three people witnessed this wounded man, only one person really saw him. Only one person really recognized what was going on. The priest and the Levite, who Jesus intentionally creates this story. It's like he puts up on the pedestal two people you would have expected to do the godly thing. They were the religious people, right? The priest and the Levite. Jesus was setting it up. These were like religious and honored people. But they're the ones who see this guy only enough to move out of the way to the other side of the road. These two religious people were able to tune out the obvious need in front of them because their hearts, for one reason or another, were calloused. Calloused, perhaps for a variety of different reasons. You could surmise all sorts of things, and you could even think about what your own heart might be in that situation. They're busy. They've got stuff going on. Or if you look into the cultural context here, they were Jews. That's a Samaritan, and you don't hang out with Samaritans. It was kind of like a no-no. There were ethnic walls separating them in that. Or maybe it's just uncomfortable to get involved. This guy's, you know, beaten to a pulp, and I don't know. I don't want to get, you know, in the middle of all of that. It was easier not to respond than serve. And I think that's, you know, there's a lot in our world that you could liken to that. And a lot of us don't respond because it's easier not to respond than to serve. But the risk we run when we don't respond to the needs of others around us is that we begin developing a calloused heart, which is kind of your first barrier, callousness. Because there's so much need out there, right? I can't just really see and perceive it all. I got to learn to tune it out just to get by. But the problem when you start tuning out things is that you don't just tune out the people you want to tune out. It begins creating a callous in your heart. And a callous doesn't discriminate, okay? When you're callous, you like numb out to something, and it starts to numb out a lot in your life. In fact, you can become callous to the people who are close to you, the people you'd rather not tune out. If you can treat somebody brusquely and indifferently, you can treat most people brusquely and indifferently, even in times you don't want to. Just as love trains our heart to serve the need that's in front of us, indifference trains our heart to ignore the need that's all around us. And that's why, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, especially in our culture here today, it's why it usually takes an extreme need to arouse our compassion. It's not enough to see somebody sitting on the side of the road, we're like, well, I don't want to get involved in that, I fly by. But when you hear about something truly horrific, some, you know, global disaster, some horrific circumstance where it just like, it cuts down to the core of your heart, it's because that's what it takes most of the time. It's difficult to be moved by the needs of the people closest to us because we learn to tune them out. There's a callous there. It takes quite a punch to get through that callous most of the time. So when we see a need, like on the other side of the world, like we hear about people starving to death, or you hear about young girls being exploited and all this sort of stuff, and those things are wrong, and they're the need that does need to be addressed. But we are more often inclined to help those people than we are the people groaning on the side of the road right next to us in our own life. It's just so easy to focus on them because that need cuts through the callous. Friends, I don't know if you've noticed this or not, but love often interrupts. It interrupts. It doesn't call ahead. It does not book an appointment on your schedule. If you and I are going to be people that truly love, then we are going to have to anticipate the inconvenience of what love requires, a reshuffling of our priorities and plans, not passing by on the other side of the road. Sometimes readjusting is precisely what it means to love. There's a friend of mine that goes here to Gateway who told me the story that she was getting to know some new folks here, was kind of had bumped into them, had gotten to know them a little bit, and she found out that the wife of this couple was going to be taken off for a week, and they had some young kids, and just sort of offhandedly said, you know, hey, if there's any way I can help you this week while, you know, you're, you know, somebody's out, just feel free to let me know, and didn't really even think anything about it. Monday morning at 10 a.m., she gets a frantic phone call from the dad saying, all of our childcare plans have fell through. Would you please, please help me by picking up our children from school every day this week and waiting until I can get there from work? She was like, oh, okay, like, all right. And she had things going on that week, you know, and all this sort of stuff. So she enlists the help of a friend of hers from Life Group that had kids. So they kind of pooled this together. But sure enough, every day she went and picked these kids up from school and rearranged her entire day. They hung out until dad could get there to pick them up. And that went on day after day after day after day after day. Totally kind of blew away the plan that she had for that week. But at the end of it, the wife came back and when she found out what somebody was willing to do and found out this is kind of a part of our church, she was just blown away that there was anybody that would care that much outside of her own family to care and serve for her family like that. It's an amazing story, but it's really inconvenient. Like, that's a lot going on to rearrange your entire world. So How do you even get ready for something like that? Like, do you want to be like, how do you train your heart away from callousness? How do you develop the reflex of serving somebody else in love? You're not going to like it, okay? I'll just go ahead and tell you that right off. You're not going to like it. Begin experimenting with inconvenience. Begin experimenting with inconvenience. If you want to respond to an unexpected need with the reflex of servanthood, then practice like you play. Deliberately inconvenience yourself in an intentional way to learn how to create space, how to perceive a need when it's called for, and how to take action by serving. Another friend of mine, I was trying to figure this out because he had realized there were just some patterns of self in his life. He was trying to figure out, how am I going to break this up? How do I really learn to serve other people, but I can't just, you know, be ready in a moment's notice? How do I practice? And he developed a practice of every time, you know, he would go into a public restroom. Now, public restrooms, there's a lot that we could say about that, and we're not going to say a lot about public restrooms. But one of the things he noticed that I'm sure you've noticed, have you noticed that, like, it feels like somebody took a hose to the sink in a public restroom? Like, there's just water everywhere. It's just all the time. It's just like there's just water all over the place. And he just noticed that. He's like, you know what? I'm going to develop a practice of just grabbing a handful of paper towels. I'm going to clean the sink. I'm just going to wipe up all that water every time I'm in a public restroom as a way of practicing slowing down and meeting a really menial need that maybe nobody even cares about. And it was just something personal for him. I just found out about it one day. It was a practice of learning to create that space, the reflex of going, there's a need, I'll meet it. Is there an intentional practice that God might have you cultivate in order to create muscle memory that serves others in the middle of an interruption? Something that you could practice. You know, it could be wiping down sinks. It could be, you know what, when we're at a dinner table, I'm going to do my best in an unobtrusive way to pick up everybody's dishes. I'm going to sort of clean the table. That's just my little personal practice. It doesn't mean you stand up and say, I will now, in a spirit of servanthood, don't you touch that dish. Like, it's just something that you're doing. Like, hey, this is just a practice in my life so that I'm building that muscle memory. Or like when you see trash somewhere, I'm not going to go make a big deal about it. I'm just going to go clean it up, throw it away. Maybe it could even be more formalized. Those are sort of like informal ways. Maybe it's like there's like a volunteer need in the community somewhere. I know like schools, hospitals, you don't have to tell anybody. You're just going to go, I'm going to go donate some of my time to just caring about somebody else for for a little while. You know, that's one of the reasons we have serving opportunities here that you find out about at Starting Gate. If you're looking for a way to put that into practice, whether it's with kids or students or, you know, greeting somebody here, it's just, part of it is, yeah, caring for this community, but part of it's going, I'm just seizing the opportunity to create that intentional practice of not being about me for a little bit. Callousness is a big barrier, though. You're going to have to grapple with that if you're really going to serve other people in love. But secondly, you're going to follow the Samaritan into another barrier. So the Samaritan has this, obviously mastered the habit of responding to a need, even when it was an interruption. And Jesus goes on and finishes his story. He says, speaking of the Samaritan, he went to him, the wounded man, and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine like an antiseptic. And then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii, coins, and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said. And when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? Jesus asks. The expert in the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. Jesus told him, go and do likewise. We love this story. It's the Good Samaritan. It's been told over and over. But I think we also fear this story if you're going to really use it as kind of a leap-off point for love serves. Because if this is how love serves, it leads us to the second barrier, messiness. This is messy. There's no clear way in or out of serving like this, right? Serving is messy because to serve someone, you're usually in their personal space in some way because you're meeting a need. They're vulnerable. It's like they can't do this for themselves, so you're stepping into it, and it just can get weird fast. You're not sure how this is going to go. You're not sure how you're going to get out of this when you want to get out of it. You're not sure how they're even going to receive it. Think about how messy this was with the Samaritan. He saw one need. Let me just bandage this guy's wounds. Then he saw another need. Well, he probably needs shelter and some sort of ongoing care for this. Then he saw another one. Well, who's going to pay for that once we actually get him to the inn? And then another. Well, I better come back and he might need that care. And so I'm going to have to make a follow-up visit and pay anything that he received for ongoing treatment. What started as one need became a lot of needs. And that is messy. And that is where, again, we are called on to trust God and the way of his kingdom. Like, hey, God, if I follow you into this mess, are you going to get me out? Like, am I going to get stuck in the middle of this? What's going to happen to me in this? You're going to help me find my way through this, right, God? I think God would love to help more people through messes if they are caused by loving someone life by life. If it's caused by that kind of servanthood, frankly, I think God would settle sometimes to just go, you know what? I just want to get your toe in the water of the mess sometimes. Like that's probably where he's trying to get more of us to actually move towards serving the people around us. Now remember though, it's so easy. Once you spend time in this, you're like, okay, so the Samaritan was this and who are these people? This was a story. Jesus told this as a story, an example of what loving a neighbor might actually look like. And yeah, he uses an extreme example to make a point, to capture our attention and make a strong point. And it's simply this, love meets a need when it sees one. That's what love does. It sees a need and it moves towards it. Now, I know we have all these Hollywood images and cultural expectations of what love really looks like, but in actuality, love is intensely practical. It moves towards, it meets a need. That's what you hear in Brian and Amy Stallings. It turned into a church, but for most people, it never will. It just started for them of going, hey, there are some hungry people all around us in Branson. You know what? It didn't take somebody with like a lot of education or a lot of like analysis of Branson to be able to come up with that. It was all around, but it had been tuned out. And there were some people who were willing to see and then go, you know what? There's some hungry people. Maybe we could bring Thanksgiving dinner. And then they followed God into an adventure they never saw coming. Love meets a need when it sees one. But you got to notice, Jesus is pretty loose on details. He tells a story. For you A-types, for you planners out there, this is frustrating, okay? Because you want to know, okay, what's the serving box? Like, how do we check that one off? How do I know when I've done it? And Jesus says, let me tell you a story. I don't need a story. I need a checklist. It's one of the reasons, by the way, I didn't write this message and give you a bunch of, here's what you go do to serve your neighbor. Because in the end, it usually gets too specific. Like if I tell you, you know what, you should go out this week and offer to wash your neighbor's car. That could be a horrible idea because your neighbor may not want you touching their car at all, you know? They might get really angry at you and they may not even need their car washed. Maybe they just got it washed and it just creates problems. You're having to listen and pay attention. Or maybe you should go to your workplace this week and ask your coworker, what's the best way I can serve you this week? That is a weird question. And they probably don't know the answer to it anyway. Friends, the needs around us are as diverse as the people, but we have to pay attention for what is really needed, which is why you need the first 3 weeks of this series. Love cares. You got to care first. Love listens and pay attention. Love engages. You're close enough to them, and then the need starts to roll into focus. Well, I wonder if that might help. I don't know. Like, maybe. And it doesn't mean you have to go hunting for a need all the time. In fact, I don't think loving our neighbor typically requires the sort of extravagant service that Jesus lays out in this Good Samaritan parable. He's making a point. He says love does scale to meet that need. If that's the kind of need, then love would meet it. But it also can meet a lot smaller needs sometimes too. It could be as simple as, you know what, I see that my neighbor's yard hasn't been mowed in a long time and I know they've got stuff going on in their life. I'm just going to go mow it or rake their yard or something like that. It could be as simple as that. Or it could be as simple as walking out of the lobby today and there's, you know, this adopt a product. You know, there's people in our city that have need. I'm going to go buy some food for them because I have means and they have need. That's a simple way to do that. But there's more intentional things you can do. You know what, like you may know somebody at your workplace that has been hospitalized and they're trying to refigure out life. You're going, you know, I could help them come up with like a care plan for meals or maybe for their kids. That's a little bit more involved and it requires some intentionality there. And it scales all the way up to the sacrificial. Some of you have cars that you've been thinking about trading in for like, I'm gonna get a new deal on this or that. But honestly, you don't need that. And there's somebody in your life that maybe has the need for a working vehicle, single moms, all this sort of stuff that you could go, I could just give that to them. Or maybe, you know what, you got a bonus. And rather than spending it on your agenda, it kind of could become one-touch money that sort of pours into your hand and then just gets rerouted somewhere. Who knows? Love scales to meet the needs. It depends on the need in front of us. There's no hard and fast manual for precisely how to serve the people in your life because love serves isn't about rules. It's about an attitude and an action. It's an attitude that flows from the awareness, by the way, that this story is also a parable about what God has done for us. Each of us, in our own way, has been broken down and beaten up in life. We are left wounded on the side of the road, and God has no obligation to move toward us. He has no obligation to do that, yet he refuses to remain callous and indifferent. He steps into our mess, and the King of all creation serves you and me in love, life by life. And if God has done this for me, how could I ever be indifferent to you? In fact, next week, we're going to conclude this series looking a little bit closer at what God has done for us in love and how we could actually share that with other people. And it's one of the most powerful ways to express love. I think you'll really want to be here. In fact, like I said earlier, we're going to be celebrating baptism at the end of the service to sort of mark what the love of God has done in people's lives. And if you'd like to get baptized, our team would love to talk with you after the service. And you can get baptized right here before you leave. But here's the thing. Invite somebody with you. Don't miss the conclusion to this series. Be here. Be present because there's a movement of love here in Austin that we're asking God to fuel. And it really sort of kicks off in a brand new level next week as we conclude this series. But right now, I'd love to just pray for you and pray that our hearts would be willing and available to step into all that God has for us, okay? Let's pray together. God, thank you for just this time. Thanks for challenging us and thanks for loving us, for moving towards us in love. Would you open our eyes? Would you break through the calluses? And would you reassure us that whatever mess that we might step into, you'll be there with us? Because there are people in this world that need love, not just in a esoteric out there sort of way, but in a practical, hands-on sort of way. Give us these opportunities, and may we be a people who trigger a movement of love in this city. We pray in your name, Jesus. Amen. Friends, our prayer team is here. Starting Gate's getting rolling. We'll see you next week for baptism and the conclusion of this series.